Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On Monday, best-selling author Laura Lippman posted on Twitter a link to a New York Times piece and tweeted, "We need to talk about this." This being aging and beauty standards. The New York Times piece was about a famous model suing a company because its cosmetic procedure left her, in her words, quote, brutally disfigured. Linda Evangelista, who famously said she didn't get out of bed for less than $10,000 a day, has appeared on more than 700 magazine covers. She was one of the very first to become identified as a supermodel, along with Naomi Campbell and Christy Turlington and Cindy Crawford. Yes, they were smart and some civic-minded, but their faces and figures were their bread and butter, although they probably rarely ate either. For someone who's paid for how they look, that can lead to some tough choices. On September 22nd, Linda Evangelista posted on Instagram that she was suing the company responsible for creating Cool Sculpting, a cosmetic procedure that is supposed to freeze fat cells without any surgery. The 56-year-old had the procedure done, and her body reacted in a way that she says now has more fatty deposits of skin than when she went in for the procedure. She says she has been a recluse since, depressed, and citing that the media reports have described her as, quote, unrecognizable. The lawsuit and the story has set off a bigger discussion about women and aging and expectations. Rhonda Gorelick, Dean of School of Art and Design History and Theory at Parsons, recently wrote about these questions in that article for the New York Times that was titled "The Cruel Paradox of Linda Evangelista's Fate." She wrote, "The paradoxical fat deposits she cites in her suit are not the cruel, crucial paradox here. The real paradox is middle-aged women expected to look 30 years younger than they are. The films and magazines filled with impossibly smooth-skinned 50 and even 60-somethings, palatified and Botoxed and wearing hair extensions. They are living paradoxes yet presented without comment or explanation." And Rhonda joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Allison. It's a pleasure to be here.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you in this segment. Have you been following the story of Linda Evangelista and her lawsuit following a cosmetic procedure gone wrong? Have you ever gotten a cosmetic procedure yourself? And if so, what led you to make that decision? Do you have a procedure and it really changed your life for the better, or maybe you regret it? You can give us a call at 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. You can also tweet to us at @allofitwnyc. If you prefer to remain anonymous, you can send us a direct message. It comes directly to me on Instagram at @allofitwnyc. We'd like to hear your thoughts. Rhonda, what prompted you to write this story?
Well, you know, I was very fascinated when I read what Linda Evangelista had put on Instagram, and it wasn't just me. All of my friends were talking about it. There seemed to be something so tragic and ironic about her situation, but it also seemed more an exaggeration of things that already happened rather than something completely unique. And I really felt we were not addressing the deeper significance of what happens when we try to pretend that women throughout the entire course of their lives need to look the same as they looked when they were basically kids or 20-somethings. And I wanted to point out that this terrible side effect that she alleges in her lawsuit happened to her, while extreme, is actually kind of a signal, a flare of the issue underlying all of these treatments. And don't get me wrong, I am not against beauty treatments or cosmetic alterations, but I do think we have to be honest and we have to relax. If anything that this pandemic has taught us is that we really need to prize our life in all of its stages.
I want to go to our phone lines because we have, as we call it around here, a super caller. Laura Lippman, who I started the segment with, has called in. We invited her to call in. I'm so happy you were able to make time, Laura. Nice to speak with you, as always.
Always good to speak to you.
So, Laura, you know, I follow you on Twitter, and I saw that you posted this. I would love to know what it is you think we need to talk about and why you posted this article.
Well, I think we need to talk about ageism. I'm 62. I'm really upfront about my age. I'm really upfront about what treatments I do have and what I don't do. And again, I agree with Rhonda. I'm not judging anyone for what they do. And if I'm really honest, if I believed that there was you know, forms of plastic surgery and body sculpting that were 100% effective, had no side effects, and were affordable, I'd probably be all in for it. I mean, it seems to me that you see so much bad plastic surgery that it's kind of a warning that this is something that's just not going to go predictably well. And I decided that I would not do that. But I've, you know, as I age, I become more interested in ageism. And I've sort of paid attention to what people are doing in the sphere of fat activism, where people have said, no, I'm going to use the word fat. Well, I use the word old. I am old. I'm 62. That's not middle-aged. It's just not. I mean, what would the middle be? I mean, after 60, I think someone's old. I mean, I'm like someone who goes into the movie theater and like, do I qualify for the senior discount? Because I would like it, please. It just is what it is, and I'm trying to kind of live outside of it. I mean, you know, if someone compliments my complexion and asks what I do, I tell them exactly. And I say, and this happened on Twitter one time, it was like, what do you do for your face? I'm like, I use Pond's cold cream. I get regular facials. You're looking at me with a ring light on me. Mm-hmm. I stay out of the sun and I got great genes. You know, number five is kind of like the one that you can't guarantee. And I just find, I don't want to hear about people, you know, looking good for their age. They just look good. Or I don't want to hear that I don't look my age. I do look my age. This is my age. And, you know, it is a very common phenomenon for women to sort of disappear as they age, to not be seen. And it's something I've written about in my fiction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I am someone who is kind of trying to be insistently seen, realizing that that's a little bit subversive. And I'm also someone who, you know, gave up dieting at the age of 60. And it was the greatest thing I ever did. But I just, it's surprising to me the women who think they're not part of this discussion. And when I posted that article to Twitter, someone was like, ugh, I'd rather talk about anything else. Like, is if this is just about someone's vanity, is if this is only something that would happen to someone who had made a living off of her looks, I think all women and maybe all people are extremely vulnerable. And I love what the article talked about. I won't get the phrase exactly right, but it was so beautifully expressed about, you know, the violence mm-hmm. in some of these treatments and the things we do to our bodies to what end? I think it's a great conversation to be having.
Laura, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
I was happy to do it. And again, I just think it's a wonderful article, and I hope the conversation keeps going.
Thank you so much. My guest is Rhonda Gorelick. She wrote a piece called The Cruel Paradox of Linda Evangelista's Fate. We're talking about the supermodel. We're not actually talking about the actual case. We're talking about the bigger picture implications. I want to follow up on what Laura mentioned, the conversation and the way you wrote about beauty treatments or this, the way we think about these things as potentially violent in some way. Would you explain?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think the violence is not necessarily in any particular treatment, but in the disappearing of the need for or the effects of the treatment. I agree with Laura that the idea of expecting women to look eternally one age is not only deeply sexist, it's anti-human. And the violence, in the case of Linda Evangelista's treatment, she is alleging that there was true violence done to her body. But I think the expectation that women, in order to be seen and heard, have to be some approximation of their youngest self is itself the violence. The violence is treating women's lifespan as valid only for the first 25 years and the rest as a struggle to turn back the clock. I always like to say that, yes, I'm aging, but another word for aging is simply not dying. And we don't think of men in the same way. At the same time, I would like to say that there is great art in women's presentation, in cosmetics, and even plastic surgery. I'm not against any of it, but it's theater. And I think we all put together a kind of theatrical persona for ourselves daily. And we need to celebrate that and be authentic in admitting that. There's artifice but you can be authentic in acknowledging it. I think forcing people to pretend and be ashamed and hide either the fact that they are altering their bodies or that they feel the need or that they're aging, that is truly the biggest violence, putting aside for the moment the potential ill effects of a badly done cosmetic surgery.
Let's take a few calls. Our phone lines are filling up. Let's go to line one. Rachel calling in from Manhattan. Hi, Rachel. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it. I just wanted to add to the conversation. I'm 26, so I think I'm coming at this from a slightly different perspective. But I think what we have to keep in mind isn't just how this affects women of a different generation, but the fact that I know women who are my age who started having plastic surgery when they were 20 and 22.
Wow.
And started with Botox and started with injectables at 20. And then at 22, they would do, you know, their first Juvederm. And at 24, you do your first Botox shot. And at 26, maybe you do your first Restylane. Because we look at, we're so inundated by these sort of artificial images of our own faces through Snapchat, through Instagram, that we're now a part of a generation and a movement where what we see on people's faces isn't real anymore. There's no connection between what you see on an Instagram feed, what you see on a live video on an Instagram feed, and what someone's face looks like in real life. And we're sort of fighting to make our faces look the way they do in our favorite filter.
Right.
And I think what Linda Evangelista went through is another aspect of that, wanting to look the way you do in a photograph versus how you look in real life. And it isn't just an issue that affects women. You know, my mom is 65 and she's thinking about getting plastic surgery, and I'm totally supportive of whatever she wants to do. But I think it's important to remember that this is a conversation that has now come to include women who are starting as early as 18 different forms of plastic surgery.
Yeah, it started, the seeds are being planted early. Thank you so much, Rachel, for calling. Let's go to Jennifer, who's calling in from East Harlem on line 4. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for calling All of It. I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Oh, thank you for taking my call and for the great work you do every day, Allison. I thought it was a brilliant article, both in its rendition and the analysis. I just think that this is an issue now that we all, I don't care age-wise or gender-wise, we all are affected by this. And I think it is tragic that our worth is so inextricably tied to what we look like, that we are all held captive by you know, standards that are completely unattainable. I think that this recent expose about, again, the Instagram pieces and you know, adolescent girls, again, underscores this. I don't think men are any less immune to this now. You hear about, you know, a rise in eating disorders, and they've become, you know, purchasers as well of various forms of plastic surgery. You know, as a woman in my 50s, I value someone like Andie MacDowell, who recently declared via a piece I read via Vogue that at 62, she's not going to, you know, dye her hair anymore. And saying, you know, if George Clooney could be considered, you know, hot and sexy at this age, why can't I? Why do I have to be held captive to things that are no longer emblematic of who I am? And I think we all have to engage in that kind of discussion.
Jennifer, thank you so much for calling. I want to return to my guest, Rhonda Gorelick. She's an author and dean of School of Art and Design and History and Theory at Parsons. You know, it's interesting that Jennifer brings up Andie MacDowell, because I did have a question in here about Andie MacDowell and the Helen Mirrens and the Justine Batemans, who are really pushing back. And against, I think it was Michelle Lee, when she was the editor of Allure magazine, she since left, she banned the term anti-aging in the magazine.
Yes.
What do you think it's going to take for this vein of this conversation to really take hold for women like this, for people to be able to feel as strong as these women do, to be able to say this?
Well, doesn't hurt that these are some of the most iconic and beautiful and talented women of our generation. So when I see Andie MacDowell, I'm glad that the caller brought her up. I also admire her for showing her, not just her gray hair, but her growing out dyed hair on the red carpet. Helen Mirren, those other women. I think that we might be at an inflection point, in part because of the COVID year plus, almost 2 years now, in which most of us have been at home and foregoing, for whatever reason, our usual upkeep, maintenance, as it's called. I always find that a funny term.
Right.
And I do think, you know, we're emerging, and I'm seeing a lot of my friends with more natural hair, more natural skin. So it may be a good moment to combine both these sort of cinematic heroines and our own realization that we're quite fine and look quite delightful with our natural hair. I don't think there's anything. I think we need to remember also that there are toxic aspects, literally, chemically, to some of these treatments that may be connected to illness or other challenges we have medically. And I just wonder if maybe we'll start getting healthier when we stop pouring these chemicals into our scalps and injecting them into our faces. I say that, I don't know if it's going to be a complete turnaround, but I do think if any big change is going to happen, now is an excellent moment. And I also would connect it to our climate crisis, because I think we are seeing very starkly how abusing our body, the earth, has led to catastrophe. And maybe we'll sort of make the connection between that and mistreating or not valuing our own personal bodies.
Let's go to Amy, who's called in from Northport, New York. Hi, Amy. Thanks for calling All of It. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for this subject. It's actually something I've been thinking a lot about recently. I'm 61. I was a professional actress and dancer from the time I was very young, and dealt with eating disorders and all those other things that you do trying to keep up the look that you're supposed to have. There was a big part of me that once I hit my mid-50s was so grateful that I didn't have those magazine images that I had to live up to. And then suddenly all of these images started appearing of these gorgeous 60-year-olds and gorgeous 70-year-olds. And I suddenly felt this pressure once again that, oh, my God, here I am hitting this middle age and I'm suddenly being told now I have to live up to this image again. So I'm really glad that this is a subject you're dealing with, because I think it's an important one for I mean, it's always been important even mm-hmm. when I was younger, but I think it's important for older women now too.
Thanks so much for calling in. I just want to read this comment from Instagram. I had a nose job in my early 20s when I was modeling in the 80s. Everyone told me that I didn't need to do it, but I was obsessed with my nose being too large. Once my agent said to do it, I was off. I regret the surgery, not because I was disfigured, but because it changed my face in a way I couldn't anticipate. I just wish I had left well enough alone. There was nothing wrong with my face, and in fact, I preferred my old nose. I will always think twice about any future procedures. I want to slide in one more call and one more question for you, Rhonda, before we go. Let's go to Viola, calling in from Kew Gardens on line one. Hi, Viola. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great.
So my question is how do you envision the role of race in this mm-hmm. In this system, right? Because I think overwhelmingly, white women have been considered the cornerstone of beauty, you know, for well over two centuries. And so the question is why should, you know, now there's this backlash, but you benefited from it for so long. So,
yeah.
So who should take responsibility for it? I mean, you could say it's this industry that takes this mm-hmm. nebulous industry, but this industry was created by white people, so and white women have benefited from it. So that's my only comment.
Yeah, and no, so I think it's a really interesting comment, because I wanted to bring one up to you, Rhonda, before we wrap. As I was reading through various articles, there was a piece on NBC News, and this woman wrote, there's a part of me that now pities Evangelista and Paulina Poroskova and Madonna and other 50 and 60-something women who were considered paragons of beauty and sex appeal when I was coming of age and are currently coming to grips with the reality that they're no longer considered vital and attractive. Back then, I struggled with my self-worth because I knew I'd never met the standard they'd set. today they're the ones struggling. I just thought it was an interesting comment, and it sort of dovetailed with what Viola was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there is so much hurt and anger that's caused by the standards we set for women and people. And I think Viola's comment is really profound. The standards of beauty, facial beauty, for decades and decades was a Caucasian standard, which is deeply racist, as we know. I do think that it's changed a lot, and we see in, for example, the fashion industry, that there is a great new visibility for some amazing designers of color. We're seeing more diversity on the runway. And I want to believe, and I do see improvements happening. The ageism and the racism, and also I would say thinism, if you can call it that, are all connected. And I think it's important that women especially try to make common cause and see the challenges we confront intersectionally. And that's where the most power for change comes from. But it is absolutely true that, for example, nose jobs and various kinds of treatments for years were designed to idealize a kind of, not just white, but a particular kind of Anglo-Saxon, particular fair-skinned beauty, blue eyes, blonde hair. That was true in the 70s. It's definitely still there, but I do think it's modulating.
The name of the piece is The Cruel Paradox of Linda Evangelista's Fate. If you haven't read it, I suggest you do. My guest has been Rhonda Gorelick, Dean of School of Art and Design and Theory at Parsons. Rhonda, we really appreciate you joining us today.
It was really fun and interesting. Thank you so much for inviting me.
This is all of it.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.